Namo tassa bhagavato arahato samma sambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato samma sambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato samma sambuddhassa. Buddham Dhammang Sangham Namasami. Friends, in the discussions or the reading we've done so far from the Dattivibhanga Sutta, it came up to the point where the meditator is contemplating the arising and cessation of feeling based on the arising and cessation of contact. And that contemplation is leading to the ultimate maturation of wisdom, wherein the meditator is not striving for any kind of being or non-being. What does this mean? There's another sutta in the Samyutta Nikaya, which is quoted by Bhikkhu Bodhi, that's referring to some people as being stuck and others as going too far. So the one who is stuck is the person who has a desire for continuation of existence or a desire for a rebirth in a state of existence, such as in a heavenly realm, or in one of the realms that can be obtained through meditation, like the realm of infinite consciousness, the realm of infinite space, and so on. And so this there's the gross desire based on liking and disliking, which causes a gross kind of agitation. And then there's the desire for a state of bhava, a state of becoming, that causes subtle agitation. I would characterize it as a kind of an anxiety based on wishing for continuation of existence or for obtaining some kind of existence. And then the person who goes too far is somebody who sees the pain of this striving for existence, and then they become horrified and disgusted by existence, and they wish to come to the end of this assumed existence. So they are seeing the pain in the fabrication of a self, and then wishing that if the self could be destroyed, that would be the end of suffering. But that is a wrong way of taking it, because it still is on the assumption that the self is a real thing that the person is trying to destroy and get away from. But the sage, the one who's on the right path, is not either trying to create or fabricate a state of existence, and not trying to destroy or come to the end of an assumed state of existence, but instead just watching the arising and passing away of phenomena. And so then it's with this watching the arising and passing away, and this is part of the development of wisdom. This is where the Buddha said that one should be, one should not neglect wisdom. He's recommending heedfulness with regard to wisdom. So he's recommending a continued dedication of devotion, not to give up on watching the rising and passing away of phenomena, particularly in the realm of feeling. I love the word appamatto, which is the Pali for heedfulness, because it has a the root word at the very center of it is called mada, M-A-D, and mada means mad, as in insane, and it also means like intoxication, and then pamada would be like to be really crazy or really intoxicated. So pamada, heedlessness, would be like going around in a blackout. So there's like a lot of delusion in heedlessness, and then appamatta is being free from that delusion. So we could say, in a certain way, the appamatta is sobriety, a kind of sobriety that's just not swept away, that's just very cool, and just watching, just to see how it actually is. Then he's describing how this practice of contemplating the impermanence, rising and passing of phenomena leads to the non-agitation and leads to realizing the ultimate truth, which is the truth of the destruction of craving. So when he says that that this matures in non-agitation, that's referring to non-craving, being finally released from the agitation of craving, and that will be enlightenment. That's nibbana, is the freedom from craving. And so then it's becomes the supreme ultimate wisdom, the wisdom of having the knowledge of the experience of enlightenment. Then he is describing really the perspective of enlightenment, or the perspective of a fully awakened arhat, when he talks about the three other points of these four foundations: the point of truth, relinquishment, and peace. And these three are so interconnected and intertwined, it's would be difficult for me to say that we're still in the realm of gradual training. where one would then, for you know, a certain amount of time, cultivate the non-deceptiveness of the truth of Nibbana, and then subsequent to that, one would develop a relinquishment from the asavas, and subsequent to that, one would experience peace. But instead, it seems to me almost as if the Buddha is, in a certain way, exploring different facets or different aspects of the lifestyle of an arhat, or what would be the consequences of the awakening. Again, I'm going to read from the sutta. With this ultimate or the full development of this wisdom factor, possessing the supreme foundation of wisdom, namely the destruction of all suffering because of the end of craving, then his deliverance being founded upon truth is unshakable, for that is false which has a deceptive nature, and that is true which has an undeceptive nature, Nibbana. Therefore, a bhikkhu possessing this truth possesses the supreme foundation of truth. Then the next is about relinquishment, or chaga, which I mentioned earlier, is sometimes translated as generosity or giving, but that then here is described as giving up and relinquishing. And it's not only giving up things or giving up one's time or giving up the things that are unwanted, but it's also giving away all the things that seem to be the essence. I used the metaphor a couple of days ago about in remodeling a house, when the architect suggested to give up the front door and the front porch, then it suddenly became clear in the way of looking at the whole design of that small bungalow was completely transformed by giving away something that seems kind of like an essential part of a house. So we give up not only what's peripheral or the small parts or the unwanted parts, but we give up what seems to be the very essence. And the sutta says, formerly, when he was ignorant, he undertook and accepted acquisitions. Now he has abandoned them, cut them off at the root, made them like a palm stump, done away with them, so that they are no longer subject to future arising. Therefore, a bhikkhu possessing this relinquishment possesses the supreme foundation of relinquishment. Namely, the relinquishment of all acquisitions. And so then based on this relinquishment, then it comes to the peace. Formerly, when he was ignorant, he experienced covetousness, desire, and lust. Now he's abandoned them, cut them off, and so forth. So they're not subject to future arising. Formerly, when he was ignorant, he experienced anger, ill will, and hate. Now those are abandoned, cut off at the root, and done away with, so they're no longer subject to future arising. Formerly, when he was ignorant, he experienced ignorance and delusion. Now he's abandoned them, cut them off, made them like a palm stump, done away with them, so that they are no longer subject to future arising. Therefore, a bhikkhu is possessing peace. Of course, the peace is the peace from being far away, completely away from all of the agitation and disturbance that arises based on greed, hatred, and delusion. This is the supreme noble peace, the pacification of lust, hate, and delusion. So it's with reference to this that it was said, one should not neglect wisdom, should preserve truth, should cultivate relinquishment, and should train for peace. The tides of conceiving do not sweep over one who stands upon these foundations. And when the tides of conceiving no longer sweep over him, he is called the sage at peace. So it was said. The tides, what Bhikkhu Bodhi so creatively translated as the tides, it could be translated as a swelling up. And so a swelling up of conceiving is, in a certain way, when a person has pride, you might say they have a swelled head, or they're like swollen with pride, so they become very, you know, stiff with conceit, and so that's not happening, so they don't have that stiffness, they don't have that swelling with conceiving. And then the bhikkhu, the Buddha explains further what he means by conceiving. He defines, I am is a conceiving, I am this is a conceiving, I shall be is a conceiving, I shall not be is a conceiving, I shall be possessed of form is a conceiving, I shall be formless is a conceiving, I shall be percipient is a conceiving, I shall be non-percipient is a conceiving, I shall be neither percipient nor non-percipient is conceiving. Conceiving is a disease, conceiving is a tumor, conceiving is a dart. By overcoming all conceivings, bhikkhu, one is called a sage at peace. And the sage at peace is not born, does not age, does not die. He is not shaken. He does not yearn. For him, there is nothing present in him by which he might be born. Not being born, how could he age? Not aging, how could he die? Not dying, how could he be shaken? Not being shaken, how can he yearn? In a way, you could say this teaching is particularly directed to somebody who might have a strong attraction towards trying to practice meditation in a way to be reborn in one of those very peaceful, subtle realms, one of those special heavens for people who have the high attainments, the formless attainments in meditation. I don't know if it's that much true of modern people that we're led astray and we stop short of the goal because of being seduced or attracted to some kind of a heavenly rebirth. It may depend on the temperament of an individual, and it could also depend on their stage in life and their life experiences. Certainly, among people I know who have died, often they may go through a lot of suffering before they die based on illness, and it's we go to the funeral and we think, well, it's so great that they've been released from the particular suffering they were in with having to occupy a body that was wracked by disease. And all of the excruciating problems that we get involved with in trying to make the life go on a little bit longer when a person is wracked by terminal disease. But in doing that in a shallow way, we could stop short of the goal. And there are other ways that I think modern people might also fall short of the goal because they take that meditation and the benefits resulting from this Dhamma practice and from these insights as being a kind of a psychotherapy. And they're aiming for having a joyful, resilient, beautiful, flexible, peaceful mind here in this life. And they see that kind of a joyful existence in the here and now that's based on virtue, kindness, and a certain amount of wisdom, that they see that as being good enough, but don't see the danger, or don't see the a necessity to go further and to actually give up all the conceding, or to continue practicing with urgency watching how watching impermanence in particular seeing the subtle and gross kinds of suffering that arise from any type of craving at all, and having a spiritual urgency to understand that as long as they're swept up by those kind of sufferings, that they're not yet in a safety zone, they're not yet free from danger, that they're able to go on to another rebirth, are able to fall into the a circumstance where this island of beautiful, sane, and refined lifestyle that they built up can be shaken if we don't have our insight really opened up and really established, if it's just being followed based on virtue and faith, then we're not out of danger. I noticed last night that the room in the meditation was more restless than it had been in the previous couple of nights. And I realized that this is the last full day of this community retreat, and that people might be experiencing being destabilized because the mind starts to go out of the retreat and think about other things which maybe need to be taken care of, and so the impulses that are unskillful, or the asadas, or you know, irritation, or the impatience could be arising now in a way that it wasn't arising a couple of days ago. So this then is the opportunity in practice to realize that as we emerge from retreat, and some of the inner defilements that were temporarily held at bay because of the beautiful artificial atmosphere that we have of the retreat, that those difficult reactions might arise again, and so that, like for example, having a certain amount of physical pain from sitting could be that, like when the mind is very open and relaxed and very stable, that it's possible to hold that a certain amount of physical pain. But then if the mind it closes a little bit, because then the very same experience that we had before could become be provoking like anxiety and worry, or some other kind of mental reaction, and then the pain that was okay yesterday or a couple of days ago then becomes not okay, and becomes a cause of restlessness. So at this point, it's the great opportunity to take the you know, the sequence of practice and have the flexibility of picking up the approach that's suitable for what's coming up. So if possible, say with respect to unpleasant feeling, whether it be coming from something physical that's being experienced, or whether it's coming from some thought or memory or something mental that's coming along, if we've got a very settled state that's in samadhi or close to samadhi, then we can simply watch those in terms of impermanence, in terms of rising and passing away. But if our state of mind is not close to samadhi, and instead is subject to the hindrances, then we have to drop back to the teaching that was given at the beginning of the sutta about seeing how, based on feeling, the mind goes to objects and explores objects. And just be very clear and observing what it is, what the mind's doing. And doing this also with a kind of a joy, because this is what the Buddha recommended, that it's natural that this would happen, that objects will be productive of joy and grief, and the mind will go out to objects. And so we can see that, and we can say, you know, oh, the Buddha was right. If there's a certain amount of mental reactivity to the different feeling colors, then we can say, oh, the Buddha was right. This is how this is. I can see the arising of dukkha right here. And based on seeing and watching it with as much detachment and clarity as possible, then it may become sufficiently calm down or not gripping the mind so much that it would be possible to turn one's attention away from watching the mind spinning around with its obsessions, and instead turning the attention towards, for example, the physical elements, looking at the earth element, the water element, and so on, and using those contemplations to stabilize the mind and bring the mind into a more of a safe space, away from the danger of being triggered into reactivity. And then from that safe space, it may be possible to then sort of emerge from the elements meditation and recognize feelings in a way in which one is simply seeing arising and cessation of feeling without getting caught up into mental formations about it. In a lot of the suttas, the description of the goal, the description of the final goal of awakening or enlightenment is given in terms of a kind of a brief and somewhat a formulaic way. There's just a few terms in terms of seeing things, seeing the yatha bhuta jnana dasana, seeing reality as it is or as it becomes, then disenchantment, becoming dispassionate with that dispassion, being free from that disturbance, and then being free, recognizing or knowing that freedom, and then knowing that the asavas or the defilements have been destroyed. There's not that. There are many suttas that don't dwell in the rich detail that this one does about explaining the experience of enlightenment, like how is it to be an arhat. And so this is one way that this sutta is so beautiful and so inspiring, because it's giving this penetrating but very clear and vivid exploration of what is the psychology of an awakened person like, and how is that psychology different than the psychology of an ordinary person. As we are developing ourselves along the path of this Buddhist practice, it's certainly necessary to have an orientation towards the goal. And even the way it's presented, sometimes meditation teachers don't like to tell the students too much, like what's it going to be like when you obtain concentration, or what's it going to be like when you obtain stages of awakening or something like that, because then the student, in their kind of sincere wishful thinking and wanting to obtain those states, could sort of tuck themselves into it and could have a sort of a false awakening, or be deluded, that they think that they've attained something that they haven't attained. It. They're just sort of imitating the characteristics that they've heard about, or even if you met a teacher who's an enlightened teacher, imitating the behavior and the affect of that teacher who's inspired you. But still, because of the way this is described, it's almost like to do that kind of imitation of enlightenment would be a type of craving for existence. So it almost is like self-correcting, that if you're really honest with yourself, if you're trying to pretend to be Saint Holy or pretending to be, to have some attainment beyond what you actually have, you can see that you've wandered away from being completely in touch with and completely settled with reality as it is. So having the orientation towards enlightenment in that way, in my opinion, if it's properly understood, it doesn't lead to a hypocrisy or a deluded kind of imitation of enlightenment, but instead it gives a lot of encouragement for a complete honesty in our quest. And because of that complete honesty, we can know where we are and still have the confidence and the effectiveness of these practices that are given to us, and the sense of ease and confidence and a kind of true happiness of knowing that one is on the right path and one has the right orientation. Those are my reflections for now. This would be the last full talk in this series, and at the closing discussion tomorrow after lunch, we might just have a sharing from others who've been sitting, may have some reflections about this subject and about this retreat. So thank you for your patient listening.
Thank you for listening. To learn how you can support the teachers and Dharma Seed, please visit dharmaseed.org/donate.